This is another iRaw podcast.
Welcome to Our Hen House. This is Jasmine Singer.
And this is Marianne Sullivan.
And we're so happy you're with us for this week's show. Marianne's guest is Pei Su, founder of Act Asia, which is working in China and other Asian countries to change attitudes toward animals. This is a wide-ranging conversation from humane education of children to educating vets, and of course to the wildlife trade that led to coronavirus.
Yeah, I'm so happy we were able to do this at this point in time, and I think you're really going to be interested to hear what's going on and about the great work that Pei is doing. She also joins me on the bonus segment this week, which is, of course, available to all Flock members. So if you're a member, you'll get that email the Tuesday after the podcast goes up with the link, or you can always find it on the Flock Facebook page. And if you're not a member of the Flock, you can join for $10 a month at ourhenhouse.org/donate.
It's been a bit of a week. I'm not really sure exactly what to say.
Really? What's going on? Something wrong?
And it's almost, you know, you and I always say this, we record this segment like pretty close to when it airs, but not, I mean, less than a week out, but not immediately. Like right now it's 5 days before this is going to air that we're recording this, and probably everything will change in the next five
days.
Maybe
everything will get fixed before you hear this.
I just doubt that. Yeah. And so we're struggling, same as everyone else. And my heart is going out to everyone, and I want to do my best to try and be positive for the sake of our indefatigable positive sort of mindset and communication tact, because I think that that's important. And if you're interested in...
Well, I think there's a lot of reasons to be positive, too. I mean, that sounds wrong. It's not like I'm feeling positive about the world right now. But I think a positive attitude right now is really called for. I mean, panic is called for about some things, about taking precautions. But, you know, it's very easy for people to slip into like very dire frames of mind, which are not maybe they're occasionally necessary, but they're frequently not necessary in order to save yourself. And everybody gets into these ideas that we're all going to die and we're not. And it's really hard to stay in the house all the time without some kind of a positive attitude. So, yeah,
right.
Panic about things that can motivate you to do the right thing, but not about everything else, because, you know.
Well, here are the things.
We're going to get through
this. Here are the things that I think are really important right now and will continue to be: community, which we have at our hen house. Obviously, we have mastered the art of virtual community. Okay, not mastered the art, but we understand the importance of virtual community. I think that that's
vital. I haven't
even
started to master the art of community online, and I know that you have been doing some work on Zoom, which I am excited to find out about. And I have to do my classes on Zoom. And, you know, aside, you buy stock in Zoom? Because I think it's going up really fast.
Right.
But you were telling me some stuff about it that's really exciting. I want to hear more. But anyway,
yeah.
Go on.
Well,
I interrupted
but
your
you
list
have
of
been
things.
Doing things, because we had a really, we had like a Zoom hangout with five of us.
Oh, yeah. No, I've been on Zoom. And I mean, even before this all started. But, you know, I don't know all of the ins and outs. And you were just telling me some really cool things that
yeah,
I
yeah, well, you
to
could
do
breakout
sessions.
Since
I'm going to have to teach my classes on Zoom, I really want to know.
Okay. Well, there are some good tutorials that you can watch on YouTube. But it is cool. You could do breakout sessions. And I'm finding a lot of hope in the types of connections that are being forged right now. Like, for example, we had a really cool like hangout session, like I mentioned, and it was really fun. And we're going to do it every week with this group of people. And also, my mom and I were texting, and we decided to have a dinner date on FaceTime, you know, which I was like, I don't really know why we're suddenly having one. She lives in Vermont and I live in LA, but it feels like, okay, now seems the right moment.
Well, I think it's important to recognize that this is pushing us to do some things that we could have done before,
yeah.
And we weren't.
Yeah. So other things on my list are gentleness, which I think is something I'm checking myself on a lot, because, you know, gentleness means not only having gentleness with people who you might think are overreacting, and a lot of people have accused me of that, but also having gentleness with the people who are accusing you of that, which I'm trying to do. And I'm trying to just be compassionate and kind. And the next item on my list is generosity, which might include supporting such as financially small businesses or your hairdresser or your dog walker or whatever, your sanctuaries. Also, humor, I think, is really important. And, you know, that's different for different people. But just make sure it's in your life in some capacity, even if you're like at the end of the day and you put on a Netflix special or something, a comedy show, something like that. I think routines are important. You and I are used to working from home. And I think for a lot of people who are starting to work from home, just make sure you get dressed in the morning. I make my bed every day. Even if I'm, you know, working from home, it's still a very important piece of my day. And
well, yeah, I think if you're working from home, it's even more important to make your bed because you have to look at it all day.
Yeah, I think it's important to think outside the box. And I guess that is like a broad stroke of something to say. But like those of you listening who want to be working remotely but aren't because you can't, like, are you sure you can't? Like, are there ways that things like conferences or meetings can be at least partially made remote? Think outside the box in terms of like how you're going to, maybe you have a partner who you don't live with, a romantic partner. How are you going to be in touch with them? Like think about creative dates, things like that. I'm trying really hard to stay in the moment, which I haven't mastered at all, but I do have this virtual reality thing that I've mentioned on the show before, and that helps me. I do it every day, especially now. And I think staying informed is very important, but make sure that.
I think most people, of all the things you mentioned, I think that may be the one thing that I and probably a lot of other people tend to overdo a little bit. Well, like I have to stay off Twitter.
Right. I follow very responsible media, you know, and I'm very mindful that fake media exists. And yet I even fell for like some media hoaxes this past week or so.
I think because everybody's frightened. Yeah. So it's really easy for people to do something that feeds into your fears. I mean, I'm certainly frightened. You know, everybody is, but we're just doing our best.
My last one on my list is to go above and beyond. And that just means like, you know, a lot of times I think about someone, and I'll be like, oh, shoot, I haven't texted them back. Like I'm thinking of my friend Rachel right now. I haven't texted her back. So I definitely need to after we finish recording this. I want to reach out to her, maybe reach out to 5 people a day. And going above and beyond might just mean letting things go.
I'm an introvert. I'm an introvert. So if I reached out to 5 people a day, I would run out of people after the first
half of the day. Yeah. Well, I hear you. I get that. But I just mean whatever it means to you. Like for me, above and beyond might mean just like letting things go more often, which I have a really hard time. I hold on to every single little thing. I'm like glue.
Oh, I think like, and can I add one thing to your list?
Yeah, please.
If you go to the grocery store, and I know you all know this. This is not the group I would have to tell this to, but oh my God, be kind to those poor people.
Right.
They're like in the first line of defense and they get paid crap. And they're so stressed out.
Yeah, and not only that,
I don't go to the grocery store.
I have I don't see my
UPS guy because I'm kind enough not to open the door until after he's gone because I'm sure he doesn't want to see anybody.
Yeah.
But geez, these people who are out there like doing this work, they're just heroes.
Agreed. Yeah.
They have to interact with a gazillion people every day, and they must be exhausted. And they're dealing with people who are. I mean, it's got to be. That a lot of people are grouchy because when people get nervous and when people are in crowds, they just get grouchy.
And of course, medical. Well, that's
medical
what I was
workers.
About to say.
You have your friend.
Yes. One of my closest friends is a nurse in an emergency room, and she's working 70-hour weeks and she's working all the overnight shifts. And, you know, she's not being, I'm sure she's being treated kindly by some people, but she's being treated very badly by other people. And like, these are the fucking warriors right now. They're the heroes right now. And, you know, if you know anyone, even if you went to school with someone and you haven't talked to them in 20 years, find them and reach out and thank them because this is, oh my God, like, these are the people who are saving us. And they are putting their lives on the line in doing so. So anyway, so I have had, beyond that, I've had actually a really inspiring, empowering day. You mentioned recently that this is going to create opportunities for turning things virtual. And I've been lucky enough, it's not done yet at the time I record this, but a conference that I was supposed to attend that our hen house is one of the sponsors for, which is Encompass's Foundational DEI Institute, it has been moved virtual, and today was the first day of that. And we got on. It was all through Zoom and Teachable and Google Drive. So it was like a virtual conference through a variety of means. And we all got on this morning and did a check-in. And pretty much all of us were like, we have no idea how we're going to stay present. But one thing that was important to me is that the coronavirus is, of course, bringing to light in new egregious ways the inequities all around us, since the people who are most vulnerable are the people who are marginalized anyway. And so it seemed to me to add like another reason to be participating in this conference with like a sense of purpose, because it's not just about fighting racism within the animal protection movement and the farmed animal protection movement, but it's about just kind of showing up with ethical consistency in our everyday lives. So some of the questions that we are approaching, we are addressing on this conference are, this is actually from their description. Are you a white person who wants to take action in support of racial equity at your farmed animal protection organization, but feel unclear what your role is in this work? Have you been learning about racial diversity, equity, and inclusion, which is DEI, but don't know how to incorporate and operationalize these concepts at your farmed animal protection organization? And then finally, are you an advocate of color / the global majority who loves working in the animal protection movement and is trying to bring racial equity into your organization? So that's basically in a nutshell what it is. And we're going to be speaking with the executive director of Encompass, Arianna Shberdy, who's been on in the past, but she's going to be on soon specifically regarding this conference. And despite the fact that we all at the beginning of the call were like, I don't know how to focus, it was wonderful. And it was a respite. And to be on this Zoom call and seeing the faces of so many people who I admire from all across the farmed animal protection movement and beyond.
So it was specifically for farmed animal protection. I hadn't realized that.
It's
until you
just said that. It was, but there were a couple people from wild animal work as well. So it wasn't like just representative of farmed animals and farm animal protection organizations, but for the most part, I mean, there was someone from the SPCA as well. Like there, so, but for the most part, that's the focus. And it was incredible. I'm really excited to talk to you further about it.
What did you learn?
I want to save it for when I talk to Arianna, because it's like the end of the first.
That makes sense. I kind of want to know though.
It's the end of the first day. I really appreciate the learning to say the global majority. I mean, I think that's important. I really appreciate that the, you know, people who are asked to take notes in each session were people who were not of the global majority, but rather it was the white people and the men on the call. Those are things we'll talk to Arianish about. My homework is to think about what an equitable movement would look like how it would feel and what it would sound like and what it would be like. So basically just think of the end goal, which is important in any kind of campaign or any kind of visionary work. And it's uncomfortable. I mean, when you say, what do you learn? I think I'm learning to sit in my discomfort in new ways that can ultimately propel me to do better work here at our hen house and with the other work I do as well. And actually, I'll bring this up to you.
Sounds great.
One of the things I want to do is to start to talk to our guests more pointedly about these issues, like in addition to climate change, talk about like how they are working within the structures of their organizations to provide an inclusive organization and model of advocacy. And I'm excited about that. And I hope to have some of the people on the podcast who are taking part in this, in addition to Arianish.
Well, that's a lot to look forward to.
Yeah. And just in the interest of community, the other day, like kind of very, very last minute, we reached out to the Flock on the Flock Facebook page. And by the way, I hope that you join the Flock if you're not in it already. We really love the Flock. But last minute, we invited people to just a Zoom conversation, speaking of Zoom. And we had a great chat with a handful of people. We're going to do it again.
Yeah, it was really amazing to get to know people in quote-unquote person, mm-hmm. and see people's faces.
From all over the world.
About, you know, everybody's kind of, yeah, it really was, well, from several places in the world. And, you know, it's just this sense of community that we all have, that you don't have to explain anything about what you care about and why you care about, you know, mm-hmm. it's just so empowering, I think, to talk with other not only vegans, but vegan advocates and animal advocates and people who are just struggling to try to get this completely obvious message across to people.
Yeah, we did brief intros and we talked about, like, we contextualized where we were in the world and where we were vis-a-vis coronavirus. And then we talked about things like how can we support small businesses, and we batted around some ideas with that. And, you know, we're going to continue to discuss this on the Flock Facebook page as well. And, you know, some people brought up whether there's some kind of a vegan network that can help fund vegan companies, things like that. And we talked about how to bring our activism and our advocacy into our messaging now that things have changed so drastically, so quickly. And how can we help our community and our neighbors, things like that were brought up. And then we talked about how we can support one another. And so those are just a few of the things we discussed. I'm looking forward to having more discussions like that. And yeah, I guess, you know, I feel like there's been a little bit of a heavy tots, top of the show is tots. And so I just want to say something light before we switch to our interview, which is that when I was at the conference today for the DEI Institute from Encompass, one of the questions for the icebreakers after one of the like little 5-minute breaks that we had was, if you were to wear one t-shirt with one message, like every day for the next month, what would it say? Which, of course, you know, I let go of the fact that like I would probably smell really bad after like a few days in that same shirt.
Also, nobody would see my message because I don't qualify.
Right. Aside from those two things, you know.
Aside from those two issues.
Yeah.
Are you asking me?
Well, I'm totally putting you on the spot, but if you have an answer, sure. But I didn't give you this in advance, so I'll tell you what I said.
Yeah, I seriously don't.
I'll tell you
answer.
What mine said. Mine was just what I've talked to you about in the past, which is when I do stand up, I am hashtag vegan lesbian killjoy, and then your tagline that you wrote for me, which is I kill joy, not animals. And so I said that's what my t-shirt would be, because I'm not super into message wear. So if I'm going to wear it, I might as well like make people laugh. And if I'm not going to make people laugh, I might as well make myself laugh. So. Anyway, there was some good answers to it, like animal. One person said animal, just animal. And then, of course, there was like the like friends, not food. But then there were like one person said lucky bastard. They were like, because I am a lucky bastard. One person said kind. It's kind of a good question. I mean, of course, I don't know if there's any good answer. Like, ultimately, like, is there one message wear shirt that's going to be so powerful?
I'm going to give that. Yeah. I'm going to give that some
give
thought.
It some thought.
You did put me on the spot.
I know. I did.
Didn't think of anything off the top of my head, but
I know.
But I'm going to give it some thought. And then I'm going to make myself a t-shirt in my copious spare time because
you have copious spare time. Yeah.
I don't actually, you know, it's so weird. Like I keep thinking, oh, I have all this extra time. I work from home. Like, this isn't any different than what I usually do. Why I feel like I'm going to suddenly do all of these incredibly productive things and read all these books and I have so much time in my hands. It's kind of just my regular life. And yeah, I don't really get that much time on a regular basis. I'm not at all sure that's going to change.
Yeah.
I'll see a lot of Twitter. I'll get a lot of tweets read. I'm telling you that.
That's good.
Check off those tweets.
Things to look forward to. Twitter. Anyway, I am really looking forward to your conversation with Peisu. So I'd love to transition to that. And Peisu is the founder and chief executive of ACT Asia. As a sociologist, Pei focuses on the attitudes and behavior of humans toward animals and the impact on civic society. She has conducted investigative studies on numerous issues in Asian countries, such as bear farming, the illegal wildlife trade, and left behind children in rural China. She will be joining Marianne right after this. Here at our henhouse, we're very excited about all the ways to change the world for animals, and we are excited about this segment, which is going to provide a glimpse into how people from other countries and continents around the globe are doing just that. So this is our international spotlight, which you'll see more and more regularly on our henhouse, and it's brought to us thanks to the people at Lush Cosmetics. Speaking of changing the world for animals, they're doing just that with their commitment to ending animal testing. If you have any ideas of a global change maker who's working on the front lines of animal advocacy, please go to our website, ourhenhouse.org, and from there you can suggest a guest for the show.
Welcome to our hen house, Pei.
Thank you very much, Marianne. And it's great to be able to be on the hen house podcast.
Yeah, I am thrilled to have you. I've heard of your work for a long time, and I know it's very powerful, and you're doing such important work in such an important place. Before we get into the details, and there's so much I want to talk to you about, just tell us a little bit about how ACTASIA began and what your hopes were for it when you started.
Yes. ACTASIA was established by myself and another Asian veterinarian back in 2006. At the time, we felt there was not a animal groups or not a particular group working in that part of the world using our own personal experience and our cultural context. We felt it's really important, you know, to help, you know, the people in that continent to improve the standard of the animal situations, to enable more people on the ground to understand, to be kind, to treat animal ways. You know, fairness is not a concept just from the West. It actually could be found, could be developed within our own cultural context.
That's really powerful and counters there's a lot of prejudice. You know, whenever anything comes up about China, there's too much talk on social media about cultural differences, and they're not very complementary to Asian countries. I think there's huge misunderstandings there in the West. And I know you have a background as a sociologist. Has that guided what you and ACTASIA are trying to do to improve the treatment of animals?
I think that certainly has an impact from my sociological background. I don't look at the issue just is all. I look at the much wider, bigger social context, and I look at the society as a whole, how the individual behave and act within that society. That's not to say what they're doing is right for the treatment towards animals, but I do think we could not, you know, take out the social political context out when we are looking at the crisis or the conflict we are facing within our world or our society as it is. I do feel very strongly about we tend to massively generalize, you know, of people in Asia, particularly in China, especially with the recent crisis we are facing about coronavirus, the amount of racist comments, you know, the prejudice, you know, we toward the country as a whole, I think is phenomenal in a sense. And I think it's quite ironic to myself is we're talking about compassion, empathy towards, you know, non-human animals. But when we are talking about humans, we should have some sort of, you know, compassion, empathy and respect towards them as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Because it's the right thing to do and because it's the more effective thing to do. The kind of work you're doing, I think, has that kind of effect. And as long as you brought up coronavirus, since that is all anybody talks about at the moment, let's talk a little bit about it. Now, I want to get into these issues of the prejudice and why it's so wrong-headed. But can you first tell us a little bit about the wildlife trade and why it flourishes and how this started?
I think it started from that when a virus come out, you know, they were investigate and was, you know, there was different theories now, say where the coronavirus come out and how did it happen. But it was starting, you know, today it was the people working in Huanan traditional wet market. It's a seafood market. That's where the people work there. They got a diagnosis as a, you know, this virus cases to start. And of course, the market itself has not only sold seafood, but they also all sorts of wildlife has been sold there for meat consumption. And two, I think a lot of vegan movements, activists, you know, they're probably quite shocked, you know, in that part of the world. They're not in that market particularly. These animals are not only the farm animals we are thinking about, actually a lot of wildlife are using for meat consumption, that including from reindeer to the different deers or civet cats, raccoon dogs, fox, different type of rats. So all sorts of animal could be bought for meat consumption. And I think this is when it's all being kept lively to be sold market. And then the disease outbreak come out and then the market was shut down. That's how it was started. That's what it evolved to. The Chinese government are talking about the illegal wildlife trade and lead to the most recent political most important decision made by the government on 24th of February was they emphasized to ban the illegal wildlife trade. Also the completely ban of eating wildlife as, you know, meat consumption, that should be banned. However, in my blog article, we did say, you know, the current ban is very positive, but there's still some loophole within the ban.
Yeah. Can you tell us those details about how the ban should go further?
When the issue come out, Deja asking the three things. We ask the live trade of animals in the market should be permanently shut down, because it, at the time when the outbreak came out, the government order was only temporary ban. So first thing we ask to is, you know, it to ban permanently, to have any live animal to be sold, particularly live wildlife to be sold in the market. The second thing we are asking is to ban captive breeding of wildlife. This is always a big issue for us, the captive breeding wildlife, because they've been totally utilized and commercialized for using for meat, for fur, for about 3 years. So we don't think this should be carried on. So we ask for a ban for wildlife use captive breeding facilities.
Many of the animals in these markets are captive bred.
Yes, yes. But the captive bred is always could be a best mask for illegal trade as well. So one thing they can argue, these animals, they're not wildlife. They are bred to be eaten, they're bred to be used. But what our case is, to really prevent the coronavirus, any wildlife, they should not be, you know, used and bred for the commercial purposes. You know, that in extended to breed animals, breed wildlife for entertainment, to be sold in zoo and circus, to be used for fur, to be used for food, to be used for laboratories. That's what we argue. You know, that's what we ask to ban. Then the thing we ask is, we think the animals, they should not be, they are wild animals, although they may be being kept generations, regenerated to be in captive environment, but they are genetic. They are still, you know, in the way is still new to our, you know, human race. So they should not be used. They should not be downgraded as a livestock. What happened is when the ban came out on 24th of February, say, ban all the eating of wildlife, but there are certain species, for example, deers, all different deers have been downgraded as a livestock. Certainly fur animals have been, fur animals that mean including fox, raccoon dogs, and minks, they are no longer wildlife, they are livestock as well.
Yeah.
And that's the other animal species, for example, like ostrich, you know, they said this is, you know, being kept to breed in the farms for so long, so they are classified as livestock. With all this, we are saying that a complete ban for wildlife eating was a fantastic result, but this will lead a loophole in certain animal. They will still be used for, you know, in the market, because once you're classified as a livestock, however they've been used will be following a livestock law. They will be not following the same legislation as the wildlife protection laws in China.
Yeah, that's the oldest trick in the book. Just change the definition of what wildlife is, and you create these huge loopholes. Yeah. All right. So in spite of the inadequacy of the response, have you seen any shifts in attitudes in China toward the trade, toward wildlife, maybe even toward animals in general as a result of this disease? Do you see this as, I mean, I don't want to say this is an opportunity exactly, because it's a terrible thing, but is there like sort of an opportunity to like educate people about animals and particularly wildlife because of what's happened?
Absolutely. I mean, it's a tragedy and it's a very sad incident globally, particularly for China. But I do think that's what Deja has been working so hard since the beginning, you know, since the middle of January. We have been working tirelessly as a team within China, outside of China. You know, we have using, you know, this issue to raise issue to public, you know, educate them what is wildlife. You know, you have to understand that the understanding between the outside China and inside China about the West and East about animals is huge. So we use this opportunity to just go back as simple as what is wildlife? What's the problem for eating wildlife? What animals are wildlife? What's the current issue? So we educate consumers. We also use the opportunity to discuss with media as a platform. We also use this opportunity to really discuss with professionals, legal profession, academic, to say, how do we make sure our voice can be heard? you know, to discuss with the government, to submit a proposal to the government to understand what is our concern. To ban wildlife eating is good, but if the animals are still allowed to breed, what are they going to do? And this is not an issue because these certain lots of species, they were permitted to breed for food in last, you know, several decades. Now you can say it's a ban, but the pressure's still there. We've done a really quick research, just a very short telephone research last Monday. Some of the breeder, they have maybe selling frogs, you know, this, you know, wildlife species. They will breed for meat, you know, for a long time. So we say, would you still sell it? They say, oh, no, not for now. But we believe it might change later on. Mm-hmm. So this is got to be the fundamentally because there's a breeding farm there. So if this issue not, you know, going to be tackled, they need to be resolved. And then, so there's no pressure for the market to reopen. So we definitely use these to communicate media platform, lawmakers, publics, you know, and even with the school, because that's what one of our ultimate aim is influence next generation. The next generation through our education program, they learn they do not want to eat wildlife. They don't want to eat wild anymore. And from there, they can understand why in one day we can talk about factory farming issue, intensive farming. They can get into the concept, understand our language as well.
Yeah, it's sort of almost if you can get people to understand wildlife, perhaps it's a wedge into allowing them to see animals in general.
Absolutely.
In a different way.
It's a topic we can use to, you know, leverage, and we can use to for them to understand this urgency matter. You know, sometimes when you talk about certain species, they are so far away from their understanding because they don't grow up with animals, they don't go to nature, they don't see the wildlife. But if they now with this rare opportunity, sad, but it's quite how we utilize to be our advantage to advocate for the species we want to protect and for the non-human animals issue as well.
So do you work in countries other than China, or is it exclusively in China?
We have, you know, focused on China extensively for the last 12 years, but starting from last year, we have started to develop our children's education, Caring for Life for Children program, and started in Pakistan. We develop our curriculum and we provide our curriculum for the, you know, education organization within Pakistan. And they're going to teach our resources, you know, our curriculum on the ground. Mm-hmm. And it's have been started since 2018. We would love to go to other Asia countries. We frequently ask, but Asia is still quite limited in funding, so that restrict how many other countries we can go as well.
Yeah, I really want to hear more about your children's education project because I know it's a hugely important part of what you do. So can you tell us a little bit of why you feel education in general and particularly with children is so important, and is that especially so in Asia?
I will be in animal movement for 29 years. I'm working in the charity sector full-time as, you know, my professional job. For, you know, last 29 years, I have done lots of direct action. You know, I used to go to protests. I have done the undercover investigation works. I done the lobbying work. So I done all sorts of different things. It's just to prevent, you know, the cruelty want to overcome all these animal cruelty issues or animal suffering in last 29 years. But since 2012, I felt I've done my 20 years work. If I'm going to have another 20 years, what am I going to do? I feel I want to move away from firefighting mode or this band-aid strategy. I'm not saying all other people's work on direct action or rescue animals is not important. I think they are important, but I do feel I want to devote it to teach younger generation to understand what are animals. What does animal have? Animals are sentient. Animals have some, you know, feeling. They can feel pain, compassion, empathy like us. This is what I feel is missing in the big part of the work we're doing to defense for animal in the world, particularly even more rare in Asia. The kids were told by grow-ups, you know, continuously animals don't have feeling. Animals are objects. Animals don't feel anything. And I think where is our hope? They grow up be given incomplete information. They were given to never be exposed to to the positive news or positive information about animals. Then we got to say to them, you have to respect them, you have to love them. It's almost, it's too late in my view. And that's why I want to focus on the education. I want these kids to develop that critical thinking skill. They have that empathy to say, you know what? I don't want to eat wildlife. Not because you say so. It's because as a human, I do not want to do that. And I think that's our ultimate aim. And lately, because of coronavirus, someone wrote in our Facebook to say, you know, Act Asia, come on, stop your education soft approach. It's not going to get us anywhere. And I thought it was really good. You know, he asked me about this and he posted on our Facebook page. And I say to this person, I say, great. I understand this might be slow and not working, but can you tell me what works? Apart from screaming and shouting to Chinese, apart from tell them they are bastard, they are, you know, they should all get coronavirus, they should all die. What else can we do? You know, we do feel sensationally great if we condemn, you know, the country or the people there. But what exactly can we do there in addition to what we're already doing and why education is not important? I feel as hopeless as him, probably, but I do feel if we want to resolve this, we have to start sowing the seed. We have to tackle the fundamental problem we are facing.
Yeah, I totally agree that education is so important. And I also totally agree that it can be so frustrating that we have to take such a long-term view when so many animals are suffering right now. But that is what has to happen. So tell us a little bit about how the education, do you go into schools? Have you had successes? Tell us a little bit about the details of your children's education project.
The way we do it is, of course, in USA, United States, you have very successful human education program. You know, you have all different material, but this is not what we have in Asia. So when we started, we developed our own curriculum. One thing is really important, I feel, to be kind to animals or to respect nature, because we all interconnect. Human, animal, nature are all interconnected. So when we go to school, we don't just talk about animal. We position ourselves holistically. That's one thing. The other thing is, I feel to learn our responsibility towards these animals or nature is as important as any other academic subjects. So we did not just go there to give one talk. We make it as a course. It's as important as in science subjects, as important as math subjects. That's what we are trying to give the message come out. So we deliver our curriculum is for the grade 1 to grade 6. That's the age 6 to 12 years old. We also is 10 lessons per year. So by the end of 6 years, we teach the kids 60 lessons and each lessons will be 40 minutes. So it's kind of groundbreaking in a sense, is not ad hoc talk. It's just not a one presentation. It's actually a subject they should learn how this by in reinforcement year after year. We have reached more than 100 schools. We have, you know, over 90,000 students have learned this project, this course in since 2012. We have over 10 schools. They are teaching repeatedly year after year in the primary school and which are they run as well. And we feel this is a long-term change. The problem we're facing today is not going to be a quick fix. We agree education is long-term, but in some way, a lot of time we also question this, but it is too long. But change will take over the generations. You know, I don't even think in my lifetime, I will see the change in animal drastically, but I do think the change, if we start early, we will have a better platform. I always say to people, when I die, I hope China will have more radical group like Twitter or more group they want to voice for animals. At the moment, I think this is the time we want to start sowing these seeds.
So do you have trouble getting in? I know here, when humane education organizations want to go into the schools, it's a really difficult process because the schools, you know, they really control their curriculum. Is it hard to get into the schools? Because you're not, as you say, you're not just going in there with one lecture, which, you know, might be an easier ask. You really want to present a course. So do you get pushback from educational authorities?
of course, it's not an easy path we've chosen, but I think it's a very important path. We learn from the pitfalls or the challenge we observe in Western countries, for example, in the United States or in the UK. And we try to overcome that. So, for example, we don't teach the lesson ourselves. We train the teachers or we train the Caring for Life educators to teach the course because we have very limited resources. We also explain the kids actually when they are learning a course, they become compassionate, more empathetic. You know, they're compassionate. And I don't think people will disagree with you about to teach a child to be kind. And this kindness, it will be including humans. The kindness will extend it to animals. So they see the benefit from the school authorities. We're not just talking to about animal rights or animal issue. We are actually, again, I say it's a very holistic approach. And it's a solutionary base as well. It's for kids to learn to have ability to overcome the challenges they're facing in the modern society. Come back to my sociological background. You know, today the kids are facing, you know, the endangered species are extinct. You know, we have a climate change issues in the school. They have an emotional challenge. You know, in America, they have a lot of kids have a psychological issue. So this is a very, very challenging world our kids are facing today. So we are talking about its ability to have them to decide what is a sustainable world they're going to live in. What they are going to do is saying, let's use less plastic, that then we don't hurt marine mammals in the world. But I don't think at the moment it's not just saying, do this and do that, is ability. And I think if you explain that concept to a logic education authority, they say, oh, okay, this is much, you know, solutionally and long-term change they can bring to the younger generation. And I think we get that more support from, you know, talking the issue from different angle as well. And we get more positive feedback as well.
Yeah, it's exactly the same here. When people take a more holistic approach, I think people are more able to hear them than if they just go in and say it's all about animals. I know that aside from your children's program, which is sounds very powerful, you also focus on professional education, particularly for veterinarians.
Yes.
And I'm curious to know, why do veterinarians of all people need to learn more about animals?
This is a question I've been asked repeatedly. Again, we have to look at the veterinary development, the veterinary education in that part of the world. Then here, for example, the easy example is the people here who want to be veterinarian, they love animals. They have connections with animals and it even is a very typical academic subject or, you know, area to get into it. So you really need to be really high academic achiever in that part of the world. It's not particularly highly respected. It's not very, you know, high social status in the country or in that part of the continent. So a lot of them, they just choose it because of just something to study. Mm-hmm. A lot of vets I have encountered, they don't particularly like animals. They're even scared of animals, some of them.
Yeah.
And every time when I talk to people about that, they say, really? I say, yes, really.
Oh, I don't find that surprising. I mean, I think a lot of veterinarians go into it because they care about animals. But I think that there are a lot who go into it because they're interested in science.
Yes.
It's not necessarily a particular connection with animals.
Yes. And similarly, science is still quite good. Some of them, they don't even get into because they connect to science. They just say, oh, haven't got any other thing to do. Can't get into anything. Let's choose that then. You know, at least something I can get a job in a sense. So, and also I think historically, a lot of veterinary school in Asia, they focus a lot on large animals, animal in the past. So they don't really know a lot outside large animals. So when the most of the companion animals, you know, was become their main topic, but actually don't learn a lot. And the other thing is that the pet keeping culture in China is very new. It was only open up to about 1970s compared to, you know, the West, you might get back, you know, especially in Europe, you can trace back pet keeping culture back to 14, 15 centuries. You know, a lot of laws, you know, and they all have, or kings, they all have relationship with animals, but that's not what happened in that part of the world. So the gap between the veterinary standard and development between East and West is already very huge. Then we come back to say, okay, you want to change the society, right? You want to change people living in society, their treatment towards animals. Then you, apart from public, who are the main stakeholders? We identify one of the best advocates could be vets. But if the vets don't even understand animals are feeling, welfare, they're sentient, where are our hope are? So that's what we started, you know, this veterinary program back in 2009. Last year was our 10-year anniversary on veterinary education. It's really trying to teach the vets. They are already in practice. We don't focus on the vets when they are training to be a veterinary during the university. We are training them is after they become vets. They might still lack of a lot of, you know, understanding about animals or the treatments they give to animals should be, you know, animal welfare based, should continue to think about animals as sentients to provide that treatment towards them.
I know that not only do you focus on educating children and educating vets, but you focus on, I like the way you put this, educating the consumer. And I know that one of your main areas is fur. And I'm curious to know why you target fur in particular and how this campaign is developed.
You know, when we talk about educating consumers, we, you know, the organization we now focus mainly on educational project. We feel it's teaching the consumers about compassionate lifestyle. You know, you can be ethical consumers, you can be, you know, the fair trade consumers, but for us it's the compassionate consumers that's really important. And when people leave the, we buy so much in our modern society, we consume so much. Actually, we consume too much. That's why we are in a climate change, you know, problem. We consume so much, but whatever we consume should have consequence. That's what we try to tell the consumers. And this is really wide range, you know, like I said, you know, could be from, you know, eat less meat, can be even stop using the animal testing product, can start by just even stop using the, or less use of the plastic bottled water. You know, because in that part of the world, again, can be afford to use plastic water. You know, the water in the plastic bottle can be a way of better quality of life. So all this is what we try to do. It's very vast. We want to choose something to illustrate our compassionate lifestyle. And we look in the fur. Started from, again, was back about 2011. It was the coming to the year of rabbit. And because the year of rabbits, it become a very commercial, you know, year because to promote fur animals. And I did a research back in 2004 about China fur industry. And since 2004, just like 8 years later, I found that the fur industry was growing stronger and stronger. Actually, now China is the biggest consumers, biggest supporter, exporter, biggest processing company, biggest the fur farming countries in the world regarding about the fur issues. So we felt this is something that the consumer should be aware of this, because only when the demand stops, then the killing probably will stop. So that's where the angle we started. And because of the China's unique position in the fur industry, we felt it's really important to make the people, you know, within China, outside China, understand where their fur come from, how the fur was treated. I think one thing I want to emphasize is in outside of China or in the West, I think people are more conscious about when they consume what are related to animals. And I think in that part of the world, people don't tend to think, you know, I have many of our supporters, they like Asia, they want to support our education program, but they don't even make the link about they could be, you know, buying a fur trim coat without even understanding what they're buying actual real animal fur rather than just a coat they bought. And I think that's something we are trying to do as well in China.
Yeah, that's certainly true here as well, that people can be very stupid about what things are made of, particularly when they're made out of animals. Do you work on, speaking of made out of animals, do you work on food choices at all?
We don't particularly campaign for that. But like I said, in our compassion lifestyle, you know, eat less meat certainly is, you know, we promote, you know, we put in is it the compassionate lifestyle. What are the tips you can do? That's one thing. Secondly, means all our event, everything we promote, we provide will be plant-based food. Since 2014, Ag Asia have, you know, annual gala dinner. In our gala dinner is the first of its own. We provide the plant-based food to the public. They have to buy the gala dinner ticket. These are the elites in the society. They are, you know, the high achievers in the society. They could be the CEO, educated people. And every time we're at gala in the last 5 years, we have made the gala dinner always hosted in 4 or 5 star hotel. It's because we are giving our message is the richer you are, the economic situation you're better, you should be kinder, not become, you know, more, to cause more cruelty to animals as well. And the gala dinner has always well received. And to create that sort of compassionate lifestyle people can lead and to do less harm to animals as well. And really are telling the richer Chinese nowadays is the more financial improvement, the economic situation be improved. It doesn't mean to buy more fur, you know, become luxury symbol, or it doesn't mean to eat more foie gras or caviar, or even, you know, to purchase wildlife, you know, species as a tonic purpose. So this is the message we're using to promote lifestyle and buy plant, provide the plant-based foods as a very cool, trendy, the way to go forward.
Yeah, that's a very powerful message. That is something that really, that can really speak to people. And so it sounds like you're working on many different fronts. Before I let you go, I just want to return to the subject we started with, since that's all anybody talks about, the coronavirus, because I think as a result of coronavirus, there's been a lot of anti-Chinese backlash on social media. And I'm just, well, I mean, I'm sure that Chinese people know about this. And I just wonder how you counter this kind of racist messaging while still talking about the problems. How do you, that's a, it's a balance to still say, all right, the wildlife trade here or other things that we do may be wrong. That doesn't mean that these people who are racist against Chinese are right. Do you see, am I being clear?
Absolutely. I think there's a two points, you know, we can look at it. First one is a lot of cruelty caused in China is ignorance. Ignorance is the combat to education. They just don't think these animals have feelings. The way they trade, the way they treat these animals, sometimes you would just think about, seriously, why would you do that? Because, for example, I saw a trader, you know, they try to put a dog into a sack because they want to weigh the animals on a scale. And the understanding that they probably took that practice about 20 minutes, just put a live dog in a sack, weigh on a scale. It's so inhuman, cruel, I understand. But you just see how silly these people is. How could you use a live animal? Because they're so intelligent, they wriggle. You never get a weight. So a lot of the thing I'm trying to say is they are just ignorant. They just don't understand they are eating these species or they are causing these tremendous, you know, like the beating of animals is this animal just like us. And I do think that is what fundamentally missing. I don't particularly think, you know, Chinese are worked much crueler than American. You have lots of, you know, abuse in United States as well. So it's fundamentally the understanding, the recognition of the species, that's one thing. The ignorance has causing lots of problems. People don't know what they're doing. They don't know what they're eating. But I'm not trying to completely blame, saying they're blameless. The second thing we got to understand, the evolution of the civilization in the extent is in its time. If you look at the history of animal movements in the West, you know, or for example, in the UK, the first law talking about the cruelty towards animal can be back to 1824. We're now in 2020. There's no China, there was no in China called animal protection law. So we, you see, that's a huge gap in terms of the development of the attitude towards animals. There's a huge gap. You guys have, how long you have pet keeping culture? Again, I mentioned earlier, this is practice only allowed in 1970s. A lot of people still think animals are dirty. Animals have the dogs and cats. They are nuisance. You know, they don't see companion animals. They don't see them treated as their children. These are animals could be just something living and moving. And that's why I keep saying to, you know, in our writing, animal, dong is moving. Wu is objects called dong wu. It's animal, but dong wu mean moving objects. But just summarize, a lot of people, they just don't even think in their radar. Many of my friends, they still think, ooh, it looks really cute. But they're really difficult. They're nuisance, aren't they? They could bite. They could see. So they still, again, negative message can be overtaking our relationship with animals. Without looking these as a foundation, I think it's very easy. Again, it's quicker to say they are cruel, they're bastard, they are raised, you know, their race is so cruel. It's easier version because, again, come back to our society today, we want a quick fix. We want a quick answer. It's much quicker to say they are cruel and you resolve everything. But I'm afraid I don't believe we could have a quick fix. You know, we can't have a quick fix approach all the time. I agree. Sometimes we have to take a quick fix. But these, if we are only want to quick fix everything and we don't have a long-term vision, we want to just do things, hopefully it will go away. I'm afraid it's just not going to work.
Yeah, and it just brings you full circle to the purpose of your organization and your life, that education is the answer, and you make a very compelling case for it. Where can people find out more about ACTASIA's work?
Yeah, they can go to our website. It's actasia.org, and we hope people could support us. You know, I think it's a vicious circle, you're right. And how do we break the vicious circle? I ask myself, you know, when people say, oh, stop, your education approach is too soft. And I do. I sometimes use that to reflect about what I'm doing. And I really, only truth, I can't find a better answer because I just feel firefighting is important, but we've got to do more than firefighting. We've got to start thinking more than just Band-Aid approach. We've got to start it to really tackle these fundamental issues so we don't go back to the vicious circle. And I do hope, you know, you listener will go up to our website and to support us because we find so challenged to find the supporters. We found really interesting is when a lot of animal lovers, we tell them about our education approach, they will say, great, what you're doing, but I still prefer to give the, you know, my $10 to feed a dog. You know, that's all important, but then we won't be able to move forward and make this momentum to get even bigger impact as well. We're doing well in China. We have 2 offices in China. We've got more, you know, volunteer, and we want to have staff, but we need to do this professionally. We were looking at how many people in the industry are abused animals, but look at the resources we have. It's just comparison. We are just so tiny. And putting helpers to do more on the ground.
I think that's a very compelling case for the work that you're doing, which really sounds remarkable. And thank you so much for sharing it with us today on our Hen House.
Thank you ever so much. And thank you again for Hen House to give me this opportunity. And then I hope people will look at our website, go to our website, you know, and then support us. You know, just for $15, we can teach a child a year of lesson, 10 lessons. And $15 so every lesson was only $1.50. So it's really a cup of coffee, you know, a meal out. That's it. So please do support us. And thank you ever so much, Marianne.
Our Hen House has a family of podcasts. In addition to the Our Hen House podcast, which you're listening to right now, you can also listen to the Animal Law podcast or the Teaching Jasmine How to Cook Vegan podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you like what you hear, and what's not to like, please, please leave us a friendly review on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. It helps us tremendously because that's how we grow and that's how we reach more and more people with information on how to change the world for animals. Thanks for listening.
Anxiety's rising. Kind of a ridiculous thing to say these days, isn't it? Since everyone's anxieties are kind of at a fever pitch. But you'll be happy to know that the work that you do and the work that others do is making the anxieties of the animal use industries even higher. Are your elected officials working for you or animal rights activists? And this is a column by Amanda Radke, and it's in Beef Magazine. I'm sure you're all subscribers. Here's the subtitle. Are animal rights activists in the back pocket of your legislators? Doesn't she mean, are your legislators in the back pocket of the animal rights activists? I don't know. Anyway, she thinks that there's a lot of divisiveness in politics right now, or the media wants us to think so. I think actually there really is. But anyway, that's not the point. And while I think the majority of Americans have more in common than what we are led to believe, what worries me more than the perceived red and blue divide is the realization that some politicians are being influenced and doing the dirty work for slick lobbying machines, including animal rights extremist groups like the Humane Society of the United States. And trust me when I say these groups have none of our best interests as a top priority. Well, I think it's safe to say that HSUS does not have the beef industry's interests as a top priority. I don't think that's really all that shocking. But she thinks that these folks, she's particularly focused on HSUS and the Humane Society Legislative Fund, which is the legislative arm of HSUS, as she describes it. The sad reality is these adversaries are working every single day to abolish animal agriculture and eliminate meat, dairy, and eggs from the dinner table. Well, yeah, I'm hoping that's true. That is what they're supposed to be doing. And shockingly, she found that it's pretty easy to keep track of which legislators are in their pocket or vice versa because they issue their scorecard. And so we can tell. And she points out there are a total of 234 senators and representatives who score an 80 and above from the HLF. That's the Humane Society Legislative Fund, which, you know, considering how poor our laws remain, that score seems a little high. But, you know, she's shocked by it. And why is this happening? Because the HSUS and HLF spend massive amounts of money to buy new laws and regulations and to influence lawmakers to do their bidding. You know, this would be hilarious if it weren't so horrifying, because the fact is that, you know, as we all know, it's the meat and dairy industries that are spending massive amounts of money in Washington and in state legislatures. And they are the ones that are getting these new laws and regulations written on their side. And animals, oh, it's a tough road to get anything done for them. But she has a whole list of things to prove her point. And among them include California's Prop 12, Massachusetts Question 3, Florida's Prop 13. All of those three were ballot initiatives. They didn't go through legislatures. That was the whole point. The animal rights folk couldn't get anything passed in the legislature, so they went straight to the people. The people voted on it, and that's what the people want, which sort of proves the opposite of her point, that the legislators are in the pocket of the beef industry and the animal use industries, and that's why they won't pass laws that people want. Unbelievable. She also mentions California's law requiring that dogs, cats, and rabbits sold in pet stores have to come from rescues or shelters, which, you know, another thing. That is admittedly something that was passed by the legislature, which is the whole thing that she's talking about. And then there's one more thing, which I'm not familiar with. The BLM spay feasibility study. And this apparently has to do with the Bureau of Land Management, and they are doing a study to test the viability of spaying as a tool for herd management and population control. I think that might do with wild horses. I'm not sure. I'm sorry I'm so ignorant about this. But my real point here is that what she's complaining about is that 8 senators signed and submitted an opposition letter to the BLM. Like, this partly means that the legislature is in the pocket of animal rights activists. It's sad but true. 8, that's going to accomplish a lot. They're just going to be ignored. Oh my God. But they're all, they are a wreck. Judge wishes she could rule elephant a person. This is another thing, that they're a wreck because the animal rights movement actually has lost, but at least got some language like approving of their position. They get upset even when we lose. And this is from evolutionnews.org. It's by Wesley Smith. And he's referring to the Non-Human Rights Project's suit the suit brought by Happy, the elephant, as represented by the Non-Human Rights Project. And this is the elephant who is held in solitary confinement at the Bronx Zoo because she doesn't get along with the other elephants. And he's upset because the judge ruled against the Non-Human Rights Project, But she put some nice language in there and indicated that she would have liked to have declared happy a person, but the law didn't go her way and she was bound by precedent. So even when they win, they're worried about that they didn't win big enough. And he goes on to say, regarding the idea that we need this kind of habeas corpus relief in order to protect animals, this kind of thinking drives me nuts. First, we don't treat animals as mere things or as being akin to inanimate objects. After all, we don't have granite welfare laws. We don't have beach sand welfare laws. Why beach sand? But we do have animal welfare laws. I mean, his point being that animals are already incredibly well protected by the law. Is that it? Well, the point of the Non-Human Rights Project is that, yeah, we do have these laws, and they're not protecting animals, so we need some different kinds of laws. Like, you're missing the point here, Wesley. But he also points out that even if Happy had been declared a person, she would not have been granted liberty. I'm emphasizing that because he did. Rather, her custodial care would simply have been transferred from the zoo to an elephant sanctuary. Happy would have had no choice in the matter. She would not be free or autonomous. This is like, you keep hearing this argument repeated. It's totally ridiculous. Like children, this is exactly what happens to children or incapacitated persons when a habeas corpus petition is brought on their behalf by their guardian or by an interested person. And yeah, they can't be just let loose on the street. That would, they are put somewhere that is dedicated to their care rather than to their exploitation. And his third point is that if animals obtained legal standing to sue, it would enable the most radical and extreme animal rights advocates to weaponize the courts as a potent means of advancing their obsessions at the expense of human needs and courtroom resources. He seems to think that the courts would just, like, have to go along with whatever the animal rights activists wanted. The courts would just be weapons in the hand. They would have no agency of their own. Yeah, unfortunately, that would be great. I mean, it would be great if that could happen, but unfortunately, even if animals did get standing to sue, the courts would still not have to do everything that we want them to do on behalf of animals. But he's still worried, you know, winning is not good enough unless you win big. And as he concludes, it takes only one judge wanting to make history to turn the human-animal relationship upside down. He obviously hasn't heard about appeals, because if one judge decides something, you always get over. Well, anyway. And that's precisely the jurist animal rights activists are hoping to find. He's right. My sense is that they are getting close. Well, let's hope you're right for once in your life. Proposed crackdown on illegal footage obtained by extremists. This is from the UK, though it's obviously an issue everywhere. And this is an interesting point, really. It starts off by pointing out that prosecutors are effectively encouraging animal rights activists to break the law because illegally obtained footage is being admitted in courts of law, it has been claimed. Unlike the authorities, activists have no obligation to prove it is necessary and proportionate before carrying out undercover filming in breach of a person's privacy. Well, this is really about the fact that because it's hard for what in this country would be referred to as getting probable cause to go in and investigate, and any law enforcement authorities or government authorities have to have that really high level of suspicion before they can invade somebody's privacy. It's animal rights activists who are not government agents are the ones who are going in and getting the footage. And because they're not government agents, those requirements don't apply to them. They might not even be trespassing because they might have a job at the facility. So they're arguing here, and it's not a completely bogus argument, that because this is constantly being allowed, there's kind of this symbiotic relationship between prosecutors and activists to get this footage, and that really does bring the government into the equation. So they really are violating the law. At least that's what I understand about their argument here. Now, of course, how many prosecutors are really in cahoots with animal rights activists? This is not what's actually happening, I'm quite sure. But the real point here is that this is almost a concession that when these animal rights activists do go in, they get evidence that animals are being treated with illegal cruelty. And that's the problem, from their point of view, that if they weren't getting this evidence that is of activity that is going on behind closed doors, nobody would be upset. Like, they're getting this evidence of illegality. So the illegality starts with the farms. And then they're saying that getting the footage is illegal, but what illegality should we really be worried about? These are interesting legal issues, but it just really rips the lid off of the fact that this whole system is outrageous, that animals should not be held behind closed doors. Animals should not be considered private property at all. I mean, there shouldn't be any kind of property. If we were going to have farms, which, of course, as you know, I would strongly object to if I was designing the world, but if we were going to have farms, they should be always open for inspection to authorities and to the public. So we wouldn't have any of these ridiculous problems about who has probable cause or whatever it's called in the UK, legal authority for anybody to go in. So this whole ridiculous problem wouldn't be a problem. Anyway, that's my somewhat convoluted legal analysis of this issue. And, you know, they're all upset about it. They're all upset about anybody seeing what they're doing and what they want to. They always want to blame the people who reveal the truth rather than those who are doing the harm in the first place. And that's it for this week's Rising Anxieties. Well, that's it for this week's show. I hope you enjoyed it. As always, if you did, please support it by joining our flock at ourhenhouse.org/donate or by making whatever donation you are comfortable with if you can't manage to join the flock. And you can also leave a good review on Apple Podcasts, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter or Instagram. If you shop on Amazon, you can use Amazon Smile, using Our Hen House as your favorite charity. And of course, please tell your friends about us and spread the word. If you are one of our listeners who already support us, thank you so much. I can't tell you how grateful we are. Thank you to my co-host, Jasmine Singer, and to John Frusciante for his work in producing the podcast. We will be back next week with a brand new show, so don't forget to subscribe in Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you are a Flock member, remember to check your email or the Flock Facebook page on Tuesday for your bonus content. And in the meantime, keep doing whatever it is that you do to change the world for animals. You are all that they've got.
For more great iRaw podcasts, visit iRawPod.com. IRoarPod.com